is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO, Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. This is Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
What do we got this week?
What's going on? Well, this week we have some news again. Big story this week, and it's been for a few days now. We heard the story about MUFON being kind of sold to Bob Bigelow and his company.
When did that happen?
That was about a week ago.
Okay.
At least the news was about a week ago. Apparently, this contract was signed between MUFON and Mr. Bigelow back in February of 2009, where MUFON basically gives away everything they own and future, whatever they have and will have.
That includes case files. All of their
case files, databases, all their investigative services, apparently. Basically, they sold themselves out for a measly sum of $672,000, payable in monthly installments of $56,000.
I think the monthly installments stopped dead, didn't they? They got about $380,000 or so, and then it just needed. So it's half owned, I guess.
But it's very disappointing to hear this sort of thing because
now was there any fallout from that, from this information coming out? Like, did the guy who did?
Yeah, because I think the international director either quit or got fired. I'm not quite sure which one it is. The fellow that took over right now is defending their actions, but. I personally don't think this was a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure most of the investigators that belong to MUFON will not like their services to be sold, especially if they weren't told.
So, now, as a side note to this, you were the director for MUFON Ontario for many years.
Well, quite a number of years back, actually.
Yeah, and in 1993, you chose to split away from MUFON International to take MUFON Ontario out of that pot. And
yes,
maybe you could just give a little, back.
Well, back in those days, it was sort of the same sort of idea. It was they were constantly. Wanting us to give them everything we had, and nothing was coming back from them. Like, in other words, we would give them all our files, all our material that, we may have had, everything, and in turn we got basically nothing. nobody was given anything from other cases. It should have been, some exchange between the different provinces or different states and such.
Right.
But no, they just wanted the material for themselves, and that was it, which I didn't agree, and none of our fellows down here agreed either. So you decided to
split.
To split, yes. They didn't like it, but then again, hey, they couldn't do anything about it, so
yeah,
that's what it turned out to be.
Yeah, it's just there could be a misunderstanding when they see Tom Theophanis, director of MUFON Ontario, that you're connected with the MUFON International, which you're not.
No, we no longer are connected, nor were we connected then, nor now.
So there you go.
Not a problem. Tonight we have a couple of great guests, special great guests. Carol Rainey, who has been making award-winning documentaries for PBS, cable networks, and commercial distribution for over two decades. In the past, She has focused mainly on scientific and medical subjects. She's currently working on a feature-length documentary about her 10-year journey into the heart of the UFO mystery as the wife and filmmaker of alien abduction investigator Bud Hopkins. Several of Carol's narrative short films and original screenplays have won many awards. She has written additional feature-length screenplays and teleplays and co-authored Hopkins' book, Sight Unseen. Our other special guest is Dr. Tyler Cogjohn, who is a PhD in biochemistry from Loyola University in Chicago and a professor of microbiology at the Arizona State of Osteopathetic Medicine. He is also an adjunct senior scientist at Banner Sun Health Center Institute in Sun City, Arizona, working as a team member researching Alzheimer's disease, biochemistry, and the effects of immunotherapy in AD pathology and dementia. And he has been a long-standing interest in the UFO phenomenon, and after a long absence, began back in the field again back in 2008. Welcome both. Hi, Carol.
Thank you.
And hi, Dr. Tyler.
How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Nice.
Oh, great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming. Thanks for taking the time to come in and talk about what you're doing.
Thanks. Appreciate the setting.
Well, so Carol, tell us how you got involved in this and what brought you to what's going on today.
Well, I had no background in the popular cultural icons of science fiction, none at all. I grew up in a fundamentalist family in the Midwest where, you know, we didn't have popular magazines, we didn't have television, go to movies or anything like that. So I basically, and then going straight into academia out of that, I really was completely just knocked out when I met Bud Hopkins in 1995. And we began, you know, a romance. And I couldn't believe what he was telling me. I liked this man, this artist, but I wasn't entirely sure he was sane. So I did what people in academia do. I went back to the sources and I went back. I think I started with Donald Kehoe's book and began to read forward from there and decided that Bud might just be quite sane, and this was really fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I came to New York and we were married, I was really, it was in our life. You know, just
you were in the thick of it.
In day and night.
big part of your life.
Yes, absolutely. I was fascinated.
Well, it certainly is interesting.
Was it like a continuous flow of this type of stuff?
More of a stream of kind of constant chaos. You never quite knew what was going to happen or who was going to be coming through the door and which media company, which television station or film crew might show up. And, you know, you kind of had to restructure your whole day there on the spot. It was
information overload.
A little, but it was just so fascinating the first 4 years, because I just didn't know anything about serious paranormal study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that. At what point did you, we all can get fascinated with things and go, wow, and just be living in the moment. Once you're on the ride's great. You know, I mean, at what point did your sort of more scientific mind reflect back and go, wait a minute, there's a couple of points here that aren't really connecting.
About five times an hour.
Right, I see. So, but that was from the early stages, or was that
later on? Yes.
Okay.
No, I would say there was a short period where kind of all the what I would call the skeptical defenses kind of dropped, and I was really completely open to all of it. And you don't quite see it coming. And so when you sort of wake up and realize that's where you are, it's a little shocking. But I really never completely stopped saying, yeah, but if you said this, yeah, but it could be that. And that's sort of what I do. But
okay. So you did question that. Now, where did it go from there? How did it expand beyond that? Your questioning, was it being taken seriously, or was there any particular cases that stood out as your skeptical mind was going, hold on a minute here?
I think there were various. It's such a mixed crew of people who come in to explore their experiences that it's really hard to generalize. If you got a young woman in a lamé jumpsuit and said she didn't have a navel, my eyebrows would raise, you know, if my back was turned. But if there was a pretty standard sort of abduction scenario that made a lot of sense to me, and that was just fascinating.
Right.
It wasn't the really shocking stuff. It wasn't about hybrids running around on the streets and trying to rape young women. It wasn't any of that. It
was okay.
Much more standard in the beginning.
At what point during the Linda Kortile case did you start to see discrepancies?
Linda is extremely charming and very charismatic in her own way, just as Bud is. And Linda was part of our lives as a friend. And I would say it was it took a couple of years to really build up some concerns that what was being said was accurate. And mainly it had to do with what was in the book wasn't quite what I saw being happening in life around us.
Okay.
I'm trying to type at the same time. Let's see.
Okay. Well, Tom, do you have another question? This is mainly your area. I'm going to let you cover most of the questions.
Yeah, yeah. There was a point, though, in there that you started to feel that something was not right about what she was claiming.
Hold on. I'm going to turn something up here, see if this helps at all. You know, maybe we should talk to Tyler for a minute because I need to fix my audio and I have to think about it for just a minute.
Oh, sure. Okay. Of course. We can definitely do that. Tom, you want to just say, Dr. Tyler, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, hey.
Okay. Well, maybe you can give us a rundown of, how you and Carol met and,
This was it was an accident. I saw on an internet chat room, Carol had posted a comment about the Emma Woods case, and I had started to follow that, and I thought, geez, is that the person who wrote the book, Sight Unseen, with Bud Hopkins? And so through the miracle of the internet, I was able to track her down through her website. And sent her an email, and that book, Sight Unseen, to me was very remarkable, because whoever wrote that, and I found out later that Carol wrote the science part in particular, really dug down and mastered the biological sciences. I mean, they really had it. And this book was quite interesting because it's sort of science judo. A lot of the investigators kind of shy away from scientific explanations. These guys went right straight at it and incorporated it and said, okay, this would mean that, and that would imply X, and they really integrated it. So I was very impressed. And so I got in touch with her, but there was something that bothered me a little bit, and that something was the fact that if you have transgenes and you understand all the implications, there's a way to get at what's going on. There's actually a genetic way to assess some of these claims. And I asked her if she had considered that. And we just started to talk a little bit more about how you might do that. And it kind of grew from there. So it was a phenomenally interesting book. And kind of just a lucky happenstance.
Well, I really appreciate that, Tyler. I think there's still some mistakes in it. I wish you had proofread it for me.
It was the stuff that you talked about with the biological sciences was very timely, and it just was very intriguing. So I thought, you're half a step away from some really important techniques that might be able to nail some of these things down definitively. And that was why I started to search and finally found your website and began to pester you with emails. So,
okay, maybe we can talk about that a little bit. What are some of those things that help nail it down?
Well, one of the things that would be interesting is if you had a transgenic being, it sounds kind of funny. I work with those all the time in the lab, and they're mice, and we have engineered them to express Alzheimer's disease genes, and they go on to develop some of the signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's. But when they're created, the transgenes the genes are put in randomly in basically the mouse ovum, which is then re-implanted. When they come out, we don't know who's who, and it's actually a simple matter to go ahead and probe for the gene because we know the sequences. And so then we can identify the right mice just with a little tail slice, and we're off to the races. Quite frankly, you couldn't test them all. There's so much labor involved. You've really got to know which one is which. And so when you have the genetic technology, it's very powerful. You can find that one gene out of the thousands in the mouse
right.
that makes it magic.
Right.
And that's routine, absolutely
Great.
Routine.
And this applies to the alien situation in what way? Spell it out.
In fact, if you had a human-alien hybrid, you would be able to, in my opinion, if you got some samples from that entity, go ahead and have a look and see what genes are in that guy and how do they match up with the human condition. You could do that by the markers that we use, for example, in forensic exams. Or if you were really determined, maybe actually get the DNA-based sequences. Perhaps of large regions. It would depend on how much sample you had. But some of the protocols, if you watch some of the crime shows on TV, touch uh-huh. PCR, a fingerprint,
yep.
Lipstick on a glass, sufficient DNA there to actually start characterizations. A little bit of hair, if the person, the hybrid, scratches themselves, that little skin that falls off could do it. You could start to analyze. And, reading some of the books, actually Carol recommended one to me, Dark White by Jim Schnabel. It does indeed sound like there are many times when samples could be had. And either exudates, secretions, whatnot, have been around, but in the past we haven't had these tools. But in the last 10 years or so, geez, we've got the whole genomic sequence of the human being. And
right.
we've got these powerful touch PCR protocols, just all kinds of ways you could go after that. Pregnancy is one of the most interesting ones because, I can't remember the exact date, but within the last 15 years, scientists have made the remarkable discovery that cells from the baby actually stay in mom alive for decades after the pregnancy is over. And some of these claims about induced pregnancies and termination and whatnot, well, if we could examine some of the women, we might be able to say, oh, my Lord, there's a strange cell here.
Mm. So where the heck were you 20 years ago when I was doing an Ontario abduction case where the woman lost her baby?
Oh,
if we could just go back in time.
Well, can you locate her today? Because
probably not.
If possible, the cells may live on for decades. They actually may live on for decades. And it does not have to go to term. This applies to terminated pregnancies. It's kind of funny when you go back and look at the data, the original discoveries, the way this came to light is that they were doing some testing on women, and they realized that some of them showed up with these cells, and they claimed they had never been pregnant. When they went back and really carefully parsed the histories, some had had abortions. And they said, right. My God, those cells are still there. I mean, it's fantastic, phenomenal.
I have a question for Carol. Carol, do you think that the abduction research researchers would be open to this sort of information, or what's your feeling on that?
Well, I think they would love to have that, but I will tell you right now what they will say is that's all very well and good, but the aliens have a way of overriding all of our impulses, our instincts. They control telepathically what these women will be able to do when they come back and what they'll be able to bring back with them, which means nothing.
So whether that's true or not, it closes the loop.
Yeah, well.
It means, okay, well, you can't do that. That won't work.
Yes.
Well, got to be careful with that argument, though.
Yeah, but okay. these were the type of excuses that we've had all along, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You'll still get that.
I don't doubt that at all. But if you want to sort of do recursion back on that, then you'd say, well, hey, what's the deal with the screen memories? And how come they're permeable sometimes? And how can some people recall without prompting? You can kind of wipe yourself out of your position of any knowledge if you get too radical about what they won't allow. I think we have to start with the supposition that this is an interesting phenomenon. Okay, I don't deny the phenomenon. I do have grave questions about some of the hypotheses and explanations. But right. If you get back and if they were infinitely capable, we'd have no idea. Those blocks would be perfect.
Exactly.
You know, that capacity to interfere would be absolutely ironclad. And they would have wiped out David Jacobs decades ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, the problem is that, back, from the time that I sort of been involved in this field, I always found people had an excuse for every circumstance. When you give them the opportunity to come up with some kind of result, they will always come up and say, the aliens took it, the government is going to come and kill me, or, some kind of ridiculous excuse. Towards the early 90s, I was starting to get really fed up with a lot of the stuff, and I thought to myself, if we put together some good people that have the same sort of approach and ideas, we may be able to get possibly somewhere. And I put a call out to every group and every individual that I can come across Canada, from every province, and we managed to put together, actually from coast to coast, a number of groups and individuals to come together and work sort of under one heading and under the same auspices of ideas. And we managed to pull out some reasonable information. And at the same time, during the days when I used to approach people like Bud and Dr. Jacobs and numerous other individuals that were involved in the abduction phenomenon, and when they used to tell us that they had implants and different other types of material, we offered them the opportunity to send them up here, and we will get all the technical work done through our local universities. And we did
which Tom had access to at that time.
Yeah.
And it's probably worth mentioning that Tom's worked with over 100 abductions at this point.
Yeah. So we did get a lot of, implants and all kinds of strange little items. And over the years, we have done a lot of analysis on those type of things. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the big shots to give us any of that. You know, Bud, I think a few times when I met him here and offered them those kind of solutions, you know, he would tell me that he wasn't too interested in doing it because, you know, in case the objects might get lost or disappear or, you know, somebody steal it or whatever. So there was always some reason not.
But now, mostly you guys were just finding that these implants weren't, they were just, you know, normal objects that have been buried under the skin and stuff
well,
like that.
Well, I would say a good majority are mundane things, like, you know, pieces of metals and things that, you know, we get in our bodies in many different ways. I mean, there was the odd type that seemed a little bit unusual, but there wasn't anything that you could say was, you know, some kind of device, possibly, that, you know, would be a communicative type device. I tend to also think that if these fellows are, you know, ahead of us by however long, you know, we probably wouldn't have any clue as to what kind of device they may be using or what type of technique they might be using. So, you know, our way of thinking is to, you know, we're probably looking for something electronic or something, you know, that we would understand. But, you know, that would be pretty.
It doesn't mean there's not a phenomena happening. There's absolutely something happening.
No doubt that the individuals, you know, that are going through these experiences are having something, you know, some kind of experience. Now, you know, we tend to pigeonhole a lot of things, and I think that's part of our problem with this whole, you know, phenomena, anything in the paranormal type phenomena. We pigeonholed, we called it names, we call, you know, everything, you know, it's an alien, it's a gray, it's a blue, it's a white, or whatever. We can't really pigeonhole because we don't know. You know, most of these answers that we're seeking, we don't have them. You know, and when Dr. Jacobs comes out and says, you know, they're hybrids, well, what proof do we have? You know?
No, it's those declarations of this is what we know and this is what we're told. This is what we, the evidence has been amassing for years is one of their favorite statements, you know, on the podium at lectures. And based on what?
On what, exactly?
It's testimony. It always comes back to testimony.
Witness testimony.
Yes.
Right. So you've been witness to this on, like, literally on the inside for years.
Yes.
And I mean, you've seen all the supposed evidence.
Yes. Let me say this, though, first, that I think that the work that I saw Bud do initially impressed me a great deal in terms of it being a kind, caring, supportive person who would not laugh at the experiencer, who would listen, nod, and ask intelligent questions. And people who came in feeling traumatized often left feeling better. I don't dismiss that value of the good listener at all, because I think probably both of them, but especially Bud, is really good at being an empathetic person.
Yeah, I don't think we should question Bud's compassion.
No.
Because I think that exists. It's there. It's in his interview. It's in his voice. It's in the way he treats people.
Right.
But if we were going to question anything within the technique of hypnosis, as it were, what would we question? What would we question?
Lack of knowledge about a lack of sophistication on both of these researchers' part about the neurological process of the brain, how memories are processed, and how they're spit back out or not. There's I mean, I keep up on that stuff as often as I can. And it seems to me you shouldn't be messing in anyone's mind unless you have a great deal of training and sophistication in dealing with people's memories. Saying, what is the difference between, often this comes up in an interview, the first interview before anyone has hypnosis. The question will be, how do I know this wasn't a dream? And I think those explanations were often not very convincing to me, at least. So, the knowledge base in people who do this kind of research needs to be amazingly diverse across multiple fields and sciences. And Bud is not even interested in science. He doesn't even read science, nor does he read psychology. I don't know how you can do this without knowing so many different disciplines and being good in them.
But how was he performing hypnotherapy, or hypnosis, I should say, to these individuals without at least understanding what hypnosis is supposed to be?
He observed, I think for the first 5 years, he worked under three different psychiatrists who did the hypnosis. And Bud was the person sitting in, often, you know, asking questions. And he learned from observing. And I actually think he's very good at getting people into that state. I think he even goes into a very relaxed state himself. Something that I read right. lately was talking about the brain waves of two people who are very simpatico. As one-on-one, their brain waves begin to entrain.
Yeah, I was going to say sympathetic entrainment, yeah.
Yes. You know, that's amazing just to even understand at that level you are one with that person in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And influencing them.
And the again, influence.
This is not by evil intent. I think that a lot of this is from lack of sophistication in these fields.
And you wrote an article, Tom, can you remind me the name of the magazine or Carol?
It's Paratopia.
Paratopia. Magazine.
Yeah, Paratopia. And that splashed out there and created a lot of waves, and which is good. Waves are good. And has been your response from that?
Actually, from a lot of old-time researchers in the field, an amazingly positive response. People, you know, either calling or emailing me and thanking Tyler and I both for speaking up about research methods that they had all questioned for many, many years. And, you know, partly I wanted to just shake them and say, why didn't you speak up? But, you know, this is a community. It is a very insular, recursive group of people. And anything they do on one, if they do one talk show, it means they can't do somebody else's talk show because that's on the enemies list. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Really? So it's, they have that as well. And I guess that counts for speaking engagements too.
You bet.
There's the people that are allowed to talk at speaking engagements, and there are those who are blacklisted.
Yes, absolutely.
And now, just giving Bud his credit here, he always was a very good speaker.
Yes, he is.
And when he gets up on stage, and that guy's like a magician, and more power to him for that.
Yes. No, he's a natural born storyteller.
Yeah. Now, What do you think was the major motivation on either one of them, between Bud and Dr. Jacobs? Ultimately, what was their motivation?
Oh, I don't really like to go into that territory. It means I can read their minds, but I guess if you've been married to someone for 10 years, you have a pretty good idea of what moves them. I think that they are both, and I do know David. I think they are both have gotten to the point of the involvement in this paranormal research where they are completely convinced that the reality that, in my opinion, they've partially constructed, this horrific alien invasion, the secret alien invasion via the hybridization, they're really convinced this is happening. I was on the Cape with the Jacobs family, had rented a house several doors down from the place where we usually stayed for the summer. And over dinner one night, I suddenly, in a pause in the conversation with Dave's wife, I heard Dave Jacobs say, "Bud, you and I are the only people on the planet who know what's going on." And my mouth dropped open and I sort of blurted out, "God, David, that's a little bit of a dangerous way to think, isn't it? You're the only people on the planet?" And that was not well received.
Right. Little scary, really. And that was talking behind the scenes. There was no interviewer. There's no crowd. There's no.
No.
This is personally at the dinner table.
Absolutely.
So they believe it 100%.
They do.
Both believe it.
Yes, they do. Yeah. No. Somebody asked me that once. So when they get off the podium and turn away, are these guys fakes? And they start laughing at these people. No, not at all. They do believe what they're doing.
Right. But did you ever confront Bud and say, "Look, if you have a belief system, how are you able to conduct, a session with an individual or an investigation of some sort without having an impartial?"
I think at a certain point in his investigation, I think he was so convinced. He no longer felt it necessary to even take those sorts of precautions. It was just a fact. If someone would call and say they had a terrible fear of clowns and maybe mention they'd seen a UFO or something they thought was a UFO, that alone would tend to tell Bud that was a probable abductee. It didn't take much. And sometimes people would be told over the phone on the first phone call. Well, the unfortunate news was they were probably abductees.
Okay. But so that would seed planted.
Yes.
But what happened, though, in cases that they turned out to be, fakes or not,
Are you asking about a specific case, Tom?
No. Just okay. In general. Like when they would deal with something and then they would find out that maybe it wasn't what it was supposed to be or what they thought it was.
It depends how far in the Jim Mortellaro case, for example, and the Linda case, Bud went out on a limb and was presenting these cases at conferences very early on into the research. And once you stand up in front of Phil Klass and various other people and say that this is what you believe, this is what has happened, it's not just what you believe, this is what the data shows you, it seems to me for certain people it's very, very hard to back down from that. And that's very much...
Yeah, because he was already committed in that case.
Yes, you're committed. Right.
Yes. But but
I was going to ask that in situations where you've seen many, many cases besides the big named cases. Was there any case in there that you felt, it started out, within a reasonable idea and then somehow, it was found out not to be true?
I think that Bud would try not to be fooled. Nobody wants to be a fool. I think that what he often did was to if certain danger signs or flags came up. I mean, he wrote a letter to the board, his board of advisors, that said he often finds red flags and he kind of puts them aside for a while and keeps on pursuing the case. And often he finds those red flags can be done away with. And now, whether they're done away with because the research was extraordinarily good and he found the case to be real, or because he just buried the red flags, that's the question. I think in some cases, some notable cases, he was not willing to admit that he had been hoaxed.
Right. And in the scientific method, I mean, if you prove something wrong, that's a time to celebrate. That means, okay, great, it wasn't that answer. Let's go find the real answer.
Yeah, not here.
I mean, was there any cherry picking? I mean, did he go through the cases? Not just, I mean, you know David as well. So did they go through the cases and sort of cherry pick ones that had, I'd say, high strangeness or interesting, the ones that are more interesting than the others, and those are the ones you run with, sort of thing?
That was my perception, yes.
No doubt on that one.
I'd started videotaping at least 25 different cases, which would be initial interviews and initial hypnosis sessions with 25 different people in the first year. And I was really puzzled as to why usually 24 had not been pursued, sometimes even 25. And if I ask, well, what is your method for, you know, choosing the case to pursue? There was a great deal of anger there at being questioned. And I pretty much learned fairly soon that questions weren't too welcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but you were noticing, because you're the one doing a lot of the filming. I mean, you're on the other end of the camera. So after a while, I'm sure you were picking up on the fact that perhaps this case isn't exceptional enough, hasn't got enough sparkle and glitter.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that those people don't also need help.
No, and he would acknowledge that the less sparkly cases could very probably were absolutely valid abductions. It's just that, just as I got a little bored after a while standing for hours behind a camera and you hear the same standard classic narrative, Bud hasn't even, lower, higher threshold of bored. He's more easily bored even than I, and he wanted new material.
Right, right. So the next bells and whistles.
Isn't that also, though, to feed the, you know, the speaking engagements and books and whatever else needed to be done?
Well, that certainly comes out of it if you get a spectacular case.
But was it ever at any time that you've known him, like, you know, from even from his past, did you ever feel that that was a big part of the motivation that he was doing?
Oh, again, I'd rather not go too much into motivation right now.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I hear you.
One of the things that I found, you know, over the years, and that was a big thing for me, was that a lot of the what I call career individuals in this industry, you know, always needed something new, something amazing to be able to tell out there. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be in the podium or able to write books, you know. So they're always looking for this extraordinary stuff. So the more the crazier the story, the better the audience.
Yes.
And the stories better evolve and get bigger, too. I mean,
well, Linda Cortila's story has never stopped, to my knowledge. I mean, it was still new chapters to her story were being unfurled you know, yeah, I don't know, several times a year.
Right.
Yeah, but considering that you know, that case and numerous other cases were, you know, brought to be not that spectacular as it was put out, did that deter any of the individuals that were coming forward?
Not sure what you mean.
Like, when those three or four cases that, you know, that became very popular and they turned out to be not valid, how was the reaction of the people around Bud, like the people in the field itself, like that you felt?
You mean the community of abductees who were in the support group?
Yes. Yeah, the community, the other ufologists, the other people around.
My experience from the community of people around Bud is that very few people ever doubted his cases. If they did, it was done in private and sort of some private grumbling, but nobody ever publicly stood up and said, this is, except for the Mortal Arl one, but nobody ever publicly even said that. They did insist that a page go up on the website which said, you know, we've been, Intruders Foundation has been looking into the Mortal Arl case for 2 years, and we now find that there are some falsified documents and we can't verify his main story, so we are no longer considering the case. But that was 2 years into it. Many radio shows later and many articles and many blogs and webcasts.
But even with Linda, was there any real investigation ever done with Linda other than what story she had said?
Yes, he definitely did some real gumshoe sort of out on the street asking questions and probing around and going to the UN and talking to police. And yes, he did that.
Oh, okay. That's great. But it still sort of blew up, though.
A Bud and his group of people will not say that blew up at all. They think it's a very strong, powerful case that holds its weight.
Even today?
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Do you sit, okay, well, you don't think it's a strong, powerful case that holds its weight?
No, I don't.
No.
No.
And you were there right in the middle of it, so you have a pretty unique view of the whole story.
Yes, I did a bit more detective work on my own as well.
Oh, so, did you find out anything interesting?
Yes, but you'll have to wait until the documentary comes out to hear it.
There you go.
But whatever investigation that he had done, like footwork, the information that he had gotten, was it ever backed up by anybody else?
Depends what you mean. if you're asking if he actually met the Richard, the Dan, the two government agents, or if he met the third man, no, he didn't. He got letters, typed letters from all of those people. He did meet with the, and I have the audio recording, a pretty remarkable meeting with a woman. He calls the woman on the bridge, and he did meet with her at a restaurant.
Okay.
Was she connected to Linda at all?
Well, that's what you'll have to find out.
Okay.
Or she was Linda.
No, actually she wasn't.
No, okay. Was it the Linda case where Linda would call Bud and be say my cousin's going to call you later tonight and explain everything. And then Bud would get a call and it wouldn't be her cousin, it'd be Linda putting on a voice acting like her cousin. Am I getting this correctly or
It is, and that only happened once when Bud admitted it to me. I do know that.
Okay. it could have happened other times, but we don't know.
Well, so that was a little odd. There were many, many things that Linda reported that were not reported in the book because it just got too soap opera-ish to be believable.
And right.
Bud was a good storyteller.
Absolutely. He had high skill in storytelling. You just sit and listen to him for hours, right? Because probably one of the things that amazed you when you first met him.
Yes.
It's a quality that he has. He's a great storyteller, no doubt about it. Well, that's very interesting. Tom, do you have anything for Dr. Cockjohn?
Yeah, I want to find out now, what is your idea for the future right now? How should we go about dealing with this particular phenomenon?
Well, I guess I'm a biochemist, a microbiologist, and I would like to see, if possible, efforts to collect genetic data. And that could be if we have independent hybrid activity. I think Dr. Jacobs talks about that there are ways that people could collect samples. And I'm really, really intrigued by the reports of pregnancy and the possibility that we might be able to get something from women who have reported abductions and have had pregnancies that they've lost or whatnot. Can't say that maybe they'll be will be thwarted, that perhaps this controlling entity is one step ahead of us. But I think those avenues could be pursued, and I hope that they will be.
Tom's gotten samples. Tom, you had a case.
We had, like I said, quite a few samples up here. So,
what was the one with the boy though? He had
I had two circumstances where, again, it was kind of unusual. On one particular case, I'm just going to go through it a little bit here, where a young boy had some sort of experience, and the mother had called me. Now, I was very sort of suspicious because this particular family, the grandmother, was a leader of I guess you could call it a UFO group, but it was more of a, believing in a lot of strange things and,
It's like Ashtar Command or something like
that. Yeah, that type of thing. And the grandmother was running a group back in the 60s and had influence in the politics. And there was a lot of funny things that went down with this particular family. So I was very suspicious when I got a call from them because I thought, okay, well, these people are sort of in the UFO field. Why are they calling me? I went there anyways. They described that the boy had an experience that he described where he was taken up, in the ship. He fought, apparently, and they tossed him back down because he was fighting and crying and yelling and screaming and that sort of thing. When he was brought back, he woke up his mother yelling and screaming. The mother saw some yellow, orangey-yellow material on his pajamas, like he had been out, somewhere outside, running around in dirt or rolling around in dirt. So she changed his pajamas and, put it in the hamper. Didn't think much about it. She just thought the guy was having, a dream. Didn't realize, whether he had gone outside or, whatever. So at some point later on in the day, she had started the wash, but she hadn't put everything in the wash. She had one piece of clothing that still had this material on there. She was talking to a neighbor and described to him what the boy had said. And the guy said, well, wait a minute, you guys are UFO people. Why didn't you think about that right off the bat? So that's when she decided to call us here. And anyway, she gave me a piece of the clothing, which we brought here. Again,
like I said, because of my suspicion with these individuals, I wasn't too sure of the story, so I took it with a grain of salt. We did test it, and, you know, I sort of kept it to myself, you know, and to the people here. About a, I would say almost a year later, or thereabouts, maybe 2 years later, there was, again, a UFO-type case just here in Toronto. And where these orange lights were circling around a building near a park. And we had a number of calls from the people in the building. The police was called in as well. There was this one lady who had called the police and us at the same time, and the army for that matter. And we went and talked to her. She described, you know, what went down there. But then as I got to know her, I had this feeling that there was more to her story. So I started kind of probing and, you know, asking her if she ever had any other experiences, you know. And in the beginning, she wouldn't tell me anything. But as, you know, I got to know her a little bit better, she described that she had these other type of experiences that she didn't know how to describe them properly in the beginning. That turned out to be the, you know, the normal abduction type stories. So as we went on, you know, I told her, well, you know, when these things are occurring, maybe you should fight and argue with these people and see what happens.
You know? It worked for the boy.
It worked for the boy.
Okay.
So anyway, she, a few months later, her and her husband moved out to Vancouver. But I, you know, we still kept talking on the phone every once in a while. So one time she gave me a call and she said, well, you know, we had a thing last night, and boy, did I have a fight with him. You know? And my husband was there too. And, you know, even though he doesn't remember it, but we kicked her butt. So, but she said there was this strange thing that happened when you know, I came to. I had this yellow, you know, yellow-orangey material on, you know, on my face and, you know, some on my arm and in my ear. And my husband had some in his ear and stuff like that, right? So I said, well, you know, maybe dab some samples and send it down to us and see what we can come up with. As it turns out, both of those materials that she gave us and the one of the boy turned out to be pretty much the same thing. So this was
a year apart.
Yeah.
Not that Tom knows what that same thing is. It doesn't make it alien. It just makes it unusual.
No, it wasn't alien, of course not. But I'm saying the material was the same, which is, again, because of the circumstances, right? And there was no connection between the boy, which was, like, again, outside of Toronto, about 2 hours on the east side, and her being in Vancouver, which is, like, you know, about 2,000 miles on the other side.
They were analyzed to be chemically identical?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, Tom has
and they turn out to be
Toronto that he takes all that stuff to.
They turn out to be over 90% sulfur, actually, pure sulfur.
Really?
Which so, is very unusual.
Did they tell you S8 or S7, anything?
To tell you the truth, I don't remember at this point right now, but I do have the paperwork.
It's very interesting because the color would certainly be consistent with that. And the orange-red thing, sulfur melts pretty easily, and if you shock cool it in water, just basically cool it very suddenly, it has kind of an orangish-reddish color. It will revert back to its yellow form. It's only metastable. But it's very interesting.
The interesting part is that the way they described it was that both of them actually told me a similar story where they go through some kind of a shower type thing,
you know, okay. where they're giving the shower, right? And that's where they start fighting, somewhere in this shower, right? And
okay.
during the fight, you know, they get kicked out. So,
Carol, have you heard anything like that before? I'm sure you've heard it all.
the shower event is happening as they're entering the craft or exiting?
Well, in this case, they were in the craft. Well, or whatever this, you know, wherever they were taken.
I remember some sort of a gel being found on a couple of different people, or them remembering it being on them, and that it was the beings evidently told the people having the experience that it was a food. It was a nutrient.
Nah.
Wow.
I would think it would be like a decontamination for the dirty humans. Tom, you should be a peach and email Dr. Cockjaw on your lab results.
Yeah, I have to dig them out and them. Well, you see, I for all these years I hadn't said anything about it because, you know, for the most part I hadn't heard anything like it. People that I work with.
I've heard both Dave and Bud have gotten reddish orange stains for whatever that means. I think one of them had theirs tested, and there wasn't anything remarkable that came back in it. I don't remember what the content was.
Yeah, and that's part and parcel for the course. You know, I mean, what will you find? What element will you find that doesn't exist someplace elsewhere? I mean, everything.
Again, like I said, the reason why, you know, this was unusual, because I mean, for one, sulfur, you know, pure sulfur, you know, where are they going to get it from
to smudge
it on themselves or whatever, you know, and what are the chances that, you know, two circumstances with the same storyline?
No, that's an important observation. That's what makes this very intriguing.
And Tom just sort of basically kept it to himself to go, okay, this is weird enough that if I ever come across it again, because if he just throws it out there, then people can, you know, use that as an example. You know, maybe they'll go get some paste or something.
Don't know.
So he just sort of kept it as a control, control feature within investigations, but. You might as well throw it out there now, right?
Well, let me ask you one question, Tom. If I could, very quickly, your answer could make me very happy. Do you still have some sample?
And you know what? I don't think I have any more of the samples, but
okay,
because I do remember one of the samples coming back, but I don't want to say 100% okay. one way or the other, but I'll definitely take a look.
If you can find it, you know, these things are extraordinarily interesting, and you want to keep that basically where only you, maybe Scott, somebody else you trust, can get to it, and basically keep it from being contaminated. The other thing that would be important is if you, and I realize that time has passed now, an elimination sample from the family or clothing that, say, the child wore or the woman and man wore, so that it could be looked at to eliminate their cells. Because from them, from their clothing, there's going to be hair and cells and other things. And
unfortunately, at the time, most of it was, you know, my stupidity in the sense that I. You know, because I these individuals, you know, I wasn't sure of what their game was.
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't take it very serious. You know, I listened to the boy. I talked to him. You know, I talked to the parent and the grandmother, but I sort of left it at that. I didn't take it any further.
Okay.
And if it wasn't the second thing that came about when I made the connection.
Did anybody look at it, just take a look under the microscope at any of the material?
Yes, at the time they analyzed it. And
he has lab reports on
But I gotta find them, dig it out, yeah, because this is going back quite a few years back.
Because it might be kind of interesting if the cells that come off of skin are squamous epithelial cells, and they're a certain shape and sort of disposition that you can pick them out. But if this is another creature from elsewhere, and it got into it, you might have sloughed off from that person or FD. Yeah.
But see, at the time, we weren't thinking on
it's
that.
Like 20 years ago, wasn't it?
On that level, right? I mean, because like again, it wasn't, you know. When something unusual like that comes, it kind of throws you off, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it's just like the Condon report says, tomorrow everything could be different.
Right.
We could have,
right.
Now somebody out there might have heard you and realizes that, oh, okay, I could collect this. I could preserve it. Might make a difference.
It would
And the thing is, you know, it could very well have, you know, all kinds of stuff could have been out there with different investigators, you know. But the biggest problem I think we had in this field is that there wasn't enough corroboration between people. You know, very seldom you have.
Would you agree with that, Carol? Would you say that
absolutely
that they're keeping too many things tight to their chest?
Yes, absolutely.
And
I don't know how you get around that in a field where there's no institutional organization.
There's no institution.
Central control group, right?
People are actually trying to make a living off of their findings. So not only is it considered proprietary, it's essential to their their income.
I think that's part of the big problem there too is that, you know, what's the motivation? You know, if that was the thing that I fought for many, many years until I got fed up and tired of it myself. You know, most of the cases out there, you know, you would go to somebody and they'll tell you a story and they'll give you part of it. And then, you know, when you say, oh, and was there witnesses? Oh, yeah, there's witnesses. And I talk to the witness. Well, can we talk to the witness? They go, oh, well, no, we can't. Because, you know, they're secret. You know?
I've established a confidence with this witness and they respect me for that confidence. So if I was to allow you to talk to them, then I'd be breaking that confidence. Does that sound familiar, Carol?
No, I do. I want to jump in and just say I'm a little uncomfortable at the sense here of kind of being on the show to be a tattletale from behind the scenes. That was never my intent in writing the initial article.
Cool.
Yeah, I was just shocked by the Emma Woods, Dave Jacobs case.
Right.
So much that I could hardly even, I really went into a funk. I had to figure out what really I believed about this. And it went on for almost a year to really synthesize it. And I feel that there is such interest, so much about human existence that lies in these kinds of paranormal, what we call paranormal issues, because we can't explain them. And if research just worked a little bit more along the lines of a scientific method, we might be able to find something out. But the way that it's currently being done, I don't think we know anything about this unknown phenomenon.
Yeah, I get it. You're not attacking any person. You're just sort of questioning the method. We're not here to harm anybody or besmirch anybody's reputation. No. All we're asking is, in this case, for this show, all we're asking is there a better way to do this? Is there something within the scientific method that can help the people that, because when it comes right down to it, there are people out there that have experiences and they need help.
Yes, and it may not be the scientific method. That there may need. I mean, I've had this discussion with John Mack often. He always talked about a new paradigm, and what that was, nobody can quite define yet.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, the individuals that are going through the experiences, you know, need some type of help, regardless of what that help may be from a professional. Ourselves, you know, for the most part, the people that are dealing with, you know, the front lines are not that experienced for the most part. Very seldom do you have a team of individuals that have all the aspects that are needed for an investigation.
Well, so, it needs to be a team effort, in my opinion.
Yes. And you know, I've there was a time back in the, you know, early to mid-90s that we did have a pretty good team up here. We had a forensic police investigator. We had a, you know, a number of other investigators, you know, PIs. And so, you know, there was a time where we tried really hard to come up with...
what was the name of that group? Did it have a name?
Well, we, like I said, we were called MUFON Ontario at the time. And, well, you know some of the fellows here. Errol's Bruce Knapp was one of them. And,
yes.
You know, and a few others. But, you know, the problem is time. Time kind of, you know, especially when everything is out of pocket. catches up with you.
It's always that way. We're usually.
So, you know, people get tired, get fed up, and... You know, when you're not getting the proper response from, you know, your other compatriots in the same field, then, you know.
Well, not only that, they have lives.
Not fun anymore.
The people have lives to live. They got to get up. They got to go to work. They got to go home. They got to look after their family. And
yeah.
It's not an organized. It can't be a fully organized group because there's no funding.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I always said about the biggest problem in this field is that there is not a constant stream of funding. There's no available stream. I mean, when Tyler has a project, he has a very pretty clear line of approach to getting funding for his project.
Oh, my God. My life is so simple compared to what UFO researchers go through. I'm serious. I go back and I thank God I'm in mainstream science because all I have to do is secure the funding and attack the problem. I don't have all these other intrigues and issues that are legion. I mean, it's just, as I was telling Tom earlier, it's just astonishing how many different things stir this pot.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there's other countries that, just to throw it out there, there's other countries that handle the UFO issue a lot more... a lot more in the sort of the dream team that we're looking for. What is it? Japan has their own official UFO investigation.
You have to think department. A lot of that comes from Jacques Vallée and his ability to parlay, you know, basically success into something tangible. We didn't really have anybody here that could quite do that. Hynek was the closest thing, and he was marginalized. To be honest, by his compatriots. He was, I'll just throw it out there, I don't agree with this at all, but I think a lot of people would say, nope, man was a lightweight, he couldn't do anything, so he went off into paranormal land. And that's what happens to you. It's not fair, it's not right, but, oh my God, they turn on you fast.
Oh, yeah. Since you put out the fact that you're willing to help people with samples and stuff. Has anybody taken you on?
Yes. What you do find, it's quite interesting. There aren't many people that have samples, first of all. But when I do find folks that have data or samples or whatnot, and I've contacted them, about half of them, if you've never seen a mummy, you have one up there right at that point. They just shut up. Okay, that's the end of the story. But a number of people have been very straightforward and have given me samples, and that takes a tremendous amount of trust on their part because they don't know me. They don't know that I'm not some rabid debunker who will take this data and try to embarrass them. I mean, they have taken an enormous leap of faith in me. But there are people out there that they want the answers. And so Ted Phillips, Frank Fascino, you know, just have enormous respect for these guys, and they've given me little things that try to help them with, and that data is theirs. It's just as if I do biochemical consulting for a company, They own the data. I'm just processing that for them, and I give it to them. And at that point, I don't discuss it any further. But I think they'll be okay if I tell you that I've done things for them and tried to examine some samples. And and there's no quitting these guys. They want the answers. Man, that's the spirit.
So if other investigators send you material, is that something that you're willing to help with?
It depends on the actual sample because, for example, I don't have a lab where I can do genomic analysis. That's just the expenses beyond what I can do. As mm-hmm. you mentioned before, it's out of your pocket. That's how it is for me, too. I cannot bootleg this stuff off of my federal grants, for example. That's not allowed. So I have to buy the reagents, you know, purchase this or that, and keep them entirely separate. The school is generous. They allow me the use of their equipment and computing facilities and whatnot. So it kind of depends, and I'll help them to the maximum degree that I can. There are some limitations. Lloyd Pye has run into those. He would like to sequence the Star Child skull.
Yeah, but we've had Lloyd on the show, and I've known Lloyd for about 20 years. So.
And so he's run into the problem of he knows precisely what he would like to do, but getting it done is just really difficult. That's another man that I really respect his approach. But anyway, to get back to your question, yeah, I'll do what I can. And I'm very happy to help. And, you know, sometimes it's just a question of looking at data and whatnot. Yeah, I can do that till, you know, the cows come home, no problem, and happy to do it.
Carol, I have a question for you. Why do you think, or Dr. Cockjohn, that's fine, Tyler, why do you think that we don't have these sort of things in place in universities where funding is available? I mean, what is it just the ridicule factor? Is it just, aliens, whatever?
That's a factor.
Go ahead, Tyler.
The ridicule factor is definitely there. Just to come out from a practical aspect, as a young assistant professor, I'm expected to go out and bring in grants and contracts from, say, the federal government, preferably, to my school to fund my research. And those are available basically in mainstream issues, cancer research, for me, Alzheimer's research right now. Basically, that stuff is so much easier and infinitely safer than attempting to go out and attack an extraordinarily difficult and ephemeral problem that is the UFO and abduction phenomenon. There's a mystery there. I can see it. But in terms of cold, hard practicality, that's a dangerous problem for me. And so that.
And what are the odds the university back you up on that?
Zero. Okay. And the reason is the second that I hate to keep bringing it back to money, but I work with a group at Banner Sun Health, and over the years we cobble together grants. We can bring in millions. I drop that for something that has no funding and is considered fringe and out there. I'm done.
Yep.
Okay, this will be tolerated as a sidelight, and let me be very clear: the university is quite, supportive, because they do allow us to do educational outreach and whatnot. So, talking about genetics, talking about data, how science is done, that fits in their bailiwick of what I should be doing as a professor. But if I drop the funded stuff, oh man, I'm going to hear about it.
Yeah, if you went and approached them and said, "Here's the deal. I want to gather samples from all over the world if we possibly can. I'll set it up. We'll have them sent to this location. All we need you guys to do is fund us so that we can do the research over, say, a 3-year period or a 2-year period. Good luck with that.
I'm thinking $1.5 million.
Okay, $1.5 million. Sure, that would help certainly with the scientific effort. And how do you think that would work out in your end? Would your job still be available the next day? Or
If there was external money coming in from a Lawrence Rockefeller or a Bob Bigelow, sure. Mm-hmm. Okay? They would tolerate a lot more of this kind of action. If I was dropping, if I was basically dropping funded projects to pursue this entirely, I would have some difficulty. Let's put it this way. I would hear about it. I would be encouraged not to do that. You know, we'd talk about the whole thing.
And possibly that difficulty might include you in a soup line.
Well, okay. I have tenure. Okay? And unless I do something really horrible, it's quite difficult to fire me, but they can make it so that I want to be in the soup line.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
I mean, I can... a lab space can be reassigned. I can be given 10,000 hours of teaching each quarter. And I don't mind teaching, but I don't want to have, 8 hours a day every day of that. I'd like to have some time for research, too. So there are pressures that can be brought to bear. But I've reached a point in my career where I think you noticed or said in the bio, after a long absence, I've come back. I have a little bit of latitude now, and I kind of would like to have some impact in the field, and the school is generous enough to allow me that, and so I'd say, hey, thanks for that part.
So
gotta take what you get.
I want to throw this question at both of you: how do you think we can change the attitude and approach to this in a bigger way,
without the use of clubs or sharp instruments?
Sometimes my mentor, Alex Roher, has said several times that in just mainstream science, a lot of times the way things really change is that some people have to retire. And not wishing anybody ill, but sometimes for the paradigms to change and the field to change a little bit, we have to have fresh faces appear and get some new ideas. So what I would say is that one way to do that is to agitate for doing any kind of corroboration you can, and where you cannot corroborate, you have to start to think that maybe this hypothesis is a dead end and develop
right.
new ones. We've gotten really far down the pike, in my opinion, with very limited data. It's now time to pull back, assess what data we have, and make some hard decisions. So I'd say, we need to look at where we are in a hard and sometimes, I guess, cruel fashion and act accordingly. And that's step one.
If I can add, too, I also think the leadership, the senior members of this community, need to step up to the plate and act like leaders. And if one of the researchers, even though he is a favorite son, I think they need to be able to call him on the carpet and ask him to stop what he's doing if it's harmful to the subject. You can't go out and harm people psychologically or mentally, physically even, and continue to receive support. People in the field, and also individuals, people who are interested, people in the public, need to read material themselves. They need to read about hypnosis. They need to read about the suggestive context and the suggestive environment that people walk into. They're not walking in, as blank slates. They come with enormous baggage, each one of us does. And we need to sift through that and find out, what is a cultural dropping on us and what is an actual experience, so that the public needs to be less credulous too.
Do you think we really have a chance though right now, the way things are?
I personally don't.
Pretty sad then.
I will take the opposite tack and say that if people are willing to follow Carol's advice in particular, it will drive the field into a better position. In other words, less credulousness and more hard-headed, hey, what does this mean? What does that mean? I think we can hopefully be better off. But I'll just speak for myself. It's an astonishingly hard uphill battle. And
right.
There's so much emotion and so much investment it will take a long time. And hopefully, you know, maybe the inertia will be overcome. But I can't say, oh yeah, it's going to happen. I just don't know myself. I hope so.
Right.
Well, you know, I always thought, you know, a small group of real professionals could do more in a year than what this whole field has done for the last 50.
I liked your model, Tom. I thought that seemed like an excellent one.
Yeah. So I you know, if that were to put together,
Tom,
at some point.
You spent so many years banging away at that, going broke, and having no life, that you eventually just had to go, you know.
Well, I at the same time, I never put myself, you know, as a professional that I needed, you know, that needed to be. You know, when I call a professional, meaning that you have to have all the aspects of that particular team to be able to, you know, take it right from the beginning and right to the end. You know, we were laymen. That's all we are, and that's all we'll always be. You know, we can go and dig around, ask questions, do that sort of thing, but that's just a very small portion of what needs to be done.
And I think a lot of times what happens is if you do, I mean, and you did have professional people involved, you had universities involved, you had access to their lab, but a great deal of that was, yeah, we'll do the work for you as long as you don't ever tell anybody we're doing it.
Actually, the thing that I found down here was that there wasn't that much of a there was a lot of curiosity, you know. A lot of the people that were doing the testing, you know, they were curious themselves. Maybe they wouldn't come out, you know, into the media and say it necessarily. But
they wouldn't be standing on a podium, that's for sure.
No, but you know, they definitely have interest themselves. And if something were to be found that was unusual, they wouldn't have a problem coming out with it.
Right.
Oh, my God. If you find something truly intriguing, unusual, or whatever, stand clear, because the stampede of scientists to get to probably kill you.
Exactly. So, you know, everybody, you know, that's involved, I would say, would definitely have, you know, a pretty high interest to come up with something unusual.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know? But
there are some people out there, Bernard Haich, for example, that are working, and there are a number of people that are trying to as best they can combine a professional academic position and ability to go after these intriguing problems. There are a few. Peter Sturrock is probably the higher profile one in the last few years. But I would say, in my opinion, my colleagues are not hostile. They are intrigued. But they're not enough to really lay anything on the line.
Yeah, they won't. But they wouldn't put their professional reputation.
No,
in jeopardy.
No, and nor would I. I just say, you know, look, I'll go this far with the data, but that's it. You know, I mean, there's a limit, and that's as far as the school is concerned. As long as I conduct myself in a way that when they see what I've written and what I've said and done, and they go, yeah, that's fine. That comports with our view of the scientific method. I'm going to have no problem at all from the school.
Right. So maybe things are changing. Maybe the atmosphere, we're at least getting to the point where the atmosphere is opening up for this sort of more stringent research. I guess, Carol, you don't think that's the case, but you see glimpses of it maybe moving in that area?
I think that the UFO research community is so such a grab bag of talents and gifts and infighting, and you just get tired of all of that. I mean, Tom, you obviously experienced that too. You just want people to have common sense, not think that if something shows up in the window that it's the head of an alien. Yep. You know, maybe it's just a shadow of the branch. And there's just a level of, and I don't know if it's related to, I mean, I could hypothesize all day that it's related to the decline in mainstream religion. I don't know. Human beings have some sort of an inbuilt need to believe there's something out there helping us, you know, navigate through the universe. I don't know what it is. I just know that people sometimes believe a little too quickly and a little too much of everything.
As of the last few years now, what do you think, where do you think the abduction phenomenon is sort of heading to, or has it become sort of stale?
I think if it continues on the path it's on, it's going to self-destruct because it's flagrantly bizarre. I mean, if you have a professor of history who's doing hypnosis for 180 hours across the ocean on the telephone with a woman who's unprotected in case she has a heart attack or a psychotic break,
all right,
God forbid, what could happen to her? There is no protection for that woman. And then he begins to believe that he's getting instant messages from a violent hybrid that's walking outside his window. I mean, I don't know, where are we? Where are we? And that then gives him permission, he thinks, to tell this woman while she's under hypnosis that she has multiple personality disorder. That's to almost condemn someone to a terminal illness. That's a horrible, horrible disorder.
But that sounds like a professional. I mean, that would be fall within the realm of a professional, highly trained opinion. I mean, and it would be after a good deal of one-on-one contact, and you know, in I mean, this would be a conclusion you would come up to professionally if you were a psychologist after a good deal of time.
Psychiatrist.
Yeah, psychiatrist. Not something you would do on the phone. That seems odd to me.
More than odd. It's the thing that made me just say, I need to stop and examine this, because I was part of a little bit of this, nothing that horrible, but it shocked me.
Right.
And you can listen to the audio tape. Don't take my word for it.
Yeah, yeah. Just one last question, Carol. Do you think, is there any professionals right now from the psychiatry field that are working within the abduction phenomenon that can bring it forward in any way?
You know, I'm not the right person to ask about that. I really am not fully involved in that field now. I don't really know who's doing that sort of work.
Okay.
I don't know of any, actually. But.
So when you stepped back from that field, you took a complete turn and walked away.
Well, I still have some writing to do and some post-production to do.
That's right. Actually, let's talk about, you're coming out with a documentary.
I have quite a few segments edited together, but you know, it's pretty much a one-woman band, and I still need to raise money for post-production and online editing. I do my own rough cut on Final Cut Pro, right on my, you know, my two big monitors on my desktop, and most people can do that now. It's just, I worked in film for so many years that I certainly have done that many times, but I need somebody to do the polish and the music and some animation. So it depends if I can raise enough money for it. But I'm in the same field in filmmaking about this topic that Tyler would be if he were looking for research funding. There aren't any filmmaking institutes or foundations who are interested in this topic.
So you don't think Hollywood's gonna run with it?
Oh, Spielberg ran with it long ago.
Yeah,
I see.
He walked away with all the money from the material.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Good point. Valid point. Do you have a website? Could you just give out your website real quickly?
I do. It's www.carolraney.com, CarolRain, as in Nancy, EY.
And you also have a link to the article you did on that site as well.
I do. Yes, that's great. Paratopia.
Paratopia. And Tyler, Dr. Cockjohn, do you have a website, or do you want to direct people to your YouTube channel?
They can just go to the YouTube channel. I have some videos that discuss alien abductions, and that's Rewinky. That's Rewinky. Just go to Rewinky's channel, and there are several different videos on there that talk about genetic evidence and whatnot.
I was going to say, they're considerably different from the standard alien abduction videotape on YouTube. Yes.
Okay.
Folks out there can contact us, and we can pass their information to you. And, if anybody is interested in working with you.
Also, we're going to have a link to Carol Rainey's website. I also put up a link to Dr. Cockjohn's YouTube channel on the site. It's there. If anybody want to just go to www.spectrumradionetwork.com. Look up upcoming guests tonight. Tomorrow they can look up past guests or in our archives. We'll have the show up in our archives tomorrow. Within a couple weeks we'll have a YouTube version as well. Definitely very enlightening. I'm looking forward to, I really hope that Carol does get this documentary made. I think it is very important. And I, for one, want to see it.
Thanks. There's some clips on my website.
Oh, good. That's great. You do have some clips available? That's awesome.
Great.
We'll just see that.
Well, I hope we can do this again in the near future. And at the same time, hoping that some changes will occur in this whole field. But
you never know. It could happen. It could happen. Dr. Cockjohn's obviously working in that direction, and if enough of the, I think what Carol said is enough of the established names in UFO research and abduction research would stand up and back this concept, it would go a long way.
Well, we're gonna keep on fighting.
Okay.
Thanks for
again.
Your good work.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
guys, and pleasure to have you. Okay,
thanks,
guys, so that's good. That's good for this week. We'll see you next week when we're going to be interviewing the BBS Radio guys, Don and Doug and Seth. So we'll be able to hear the story of how BBS started and how it was created and the philosophy behind it. Good night, everyone.
Good night.